Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. This episode continues the Faith and Earth Care series and is the second of what looks like it'll be a three-part series with Ramis Kent to discuss Islam. Before you delve into this show, I would recommend that you go back and listen to that first episode, as there you can hear Ramis's background, biography, and how he came to do what he's doing. Before we jump into this conversation that kind of goes feet first into Islam, during this conversation, we talk about faith and mercy and grace, forgiveness, judgment, as well as the evils of the world and temptation. As this piece was edited from a larger section of raw audio, it ends without the usual closing for the show. And rather, the statement that we end with is the statement that I will pick up the next of these pieces with. If you enjoy this show or the rest in the Faith and Earth Care series, or any of the other shows in the archives, please consider supporting this podcast. You can find out how by going to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. Now then, on to Ramis Kent.
Shall we dive into this conversation about Islam, ethics, and earth care?
Let's do it.
This is your area of expertise, so why don't you go ahead and get us started? I think our earlier conversations that the listeners have hopefully heard before they explore this one with us cover a lot of the background for you and some of the historical context of Islam, as well as our conversation about like ethics and the law. Just because you can do it doesn't mean you should do it.
Right.
So if you would like to go ahead and give us kind of an outline of where you'd like to take us, and we can go from there.
I think, you know, for me, a lot of this discussion, at least as it applies to Islam, is actually trying to leverage the strength of the tradition itself, not only, you know, from the sense of the history that's actually unfolded, but just also the intellectual underpinnings of Islam, in that there's a very explicit call, actually, to this type of activity. It's not a reach, and it's not something that can be seen as an attempt to try to wring something from out of the tradition that isn't there. There's actually a very strong historical precedent for a lot of what I've been calling for, at least been trying to bring attention to with regard to this whole idea of earth repair or ecosystem restoration work, and then having that kind of take place through the use of systems like permaculture design or key line design or agroecology, any number of these kind of holistic systems. And I think I'd alluded to, you know, some of this history by looking at the works of one particular writer named Dr. G.T. Wrench. He wrote a book called Reconstruction by Way of the Soil. And one of the things he did in that book was pointed to Muslim Spain and what had been developed in Muslim Spain with regard to the system of farming and agriculture, also water management as well was highlighted, and how this was something that was a radical departure from what had been seen historically elsewhere in the world. And that this in turn allowed for the blossoming of what many would point to as one of the most remarkable human civilizations in recorded history. Many of the developments in Muslim Spain had given birth to what we know of the Renaissance in Europe. You know, this is something that I kind of point to as being solid evidence as to what can come from a focus on this activity, and in particular, a focus that an entire community can place upon this activity, and having that be fueled by a very strong and well-established ethical sensibility that is rooted in one of the most significant spiritual traditions that we have.
Can you speak some to that ethical tradition within Islam?
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, this idea that we are all beings. We live in a world that was created, that was brought into an existence by a creator, right? By what we believe to be one God. You know, there is this idea, this concept within Islam called Tawheed, the divine sort of unicity, divine unity of God. It's kind of the all powerful, the omniscient, the omnipotent, the omnipresent, and that the world is sort of a manifestation of the divine attributes of God. So everything that we see in some way, shape, or form is reflective of a specific aspect or quality of God, not in substance, but in, again, in attribute, in some kind of quality. So, you know, you see the compassion, you see the sort of the creative abilities, the beauty, the majesty, the mercy, right? And then also some of the more kind of frightening or powerful aspects of God. There is a quality called Adar, like the destroyer. He's also called the exalter and the abaser. He's actually also called the love, you know, Wadud. There's all of these qualities that you see exhibited within the phenomenal world, and that there's a responsibility that human beings have in looking after it. There is this concept of the khilafa, the vicegerency of the human being, that the human being has been charged with actually looking after or being a steward to the creation. And I think, unfortunately, this isn't necessarily something that is unique to the Islamic tradition. I think you also have that within the other Abrahamic faiths. But I think the problem is we have seen this idea of stewardship be transformed into, or at least understood as being, a domination, and that somehow there's a license that's been given to human beings to do whatever they want. And I think we've seen repeatedly what that way of thinking has resulted in, and that there's a need to return to the proper or the correct understanding of the origins of this idea of the vicegerency or the stewardship that the human being is supposed to perform for the rest of the creation.
Where do you think this understanding of stewardship has gone wrong?
It's a mistaken view of the relative position of the human being relative to the rest of the creation. And it's not having a proper understanding of the function of all of the other things that are in existence, that everything has a place. It's like a body. And I often like to use the analogy of the body. The body is sort of a unified diversity of parts, or a diversified unity of function, and that the body is not able to do what it does unless it has all of the parts. The human being is but one of the parts that make up the creation, and that it cannot be permitted to overtake or to subvert or to supplant the ability of any of the other parts that make up this body of the creation. It can't be allowed to do that, because what it does is it interrupts the viability. It undermines the functionality of the whole. And we've seen this again happen over and over again. When we read the works of people like Jared Diamond, you know, you read the book Collapse, and he talks about, you know, all of the different modes of failure for human civilization. And invariably what happens is that man has overstepped the bounds of what sort of the immediate environment is able to withstand in terms of the treatment of the surrounding habitat, be it the vegetation, right? Deforestation and habitat destruction was seen as being the number one reason why civilizations fail. And then after that, it was soil problems. And then after that, it was water management problems. And I think looking at those things through the permaculture lens, you can understand those three reasons as being all the same thing, that they're not three separate causes, that they're all the same cause, and that this is a product of an improper understanding of the position of the human being in reference to the rest of the natural world, is that we're not separate from it. We're part of it, and that we have a responsibility towards it in making sure that we serve its interests so that it's able to serve our interests.
As stewards of the world that has been created for us, we have to maintain our home. We have to take care of it or it won't be there.
You know, and not only that, you know, I think that, you know, we talked about this idea of that everything in the creation has a right. It has a right to render whatever function that it was made to perform. And that as human beings, we do not have a right to oppress another being's ability to be able to perform that function. And so, you know, I made an allusion to the works of a prominent Muslim scholarly figure named Ibn al-Arabi. And he was talking about this idea of the benefit of knowledge, the benefit of useful knowledge, and that being in the world, one of the things that you need to understand about the world is, what is everything for? What is it there for? Right? What is its function? What is its reality? And what is its right as being a created thing? And that if you properly understand its reality and you properly understand its right, if you understand the reality and right of everything that exists, then you can properly render its due, whatever might be due to it, so that it can perform its function. So, you know, people like Joel Salatin talk about honoring the chickenness of the chicken, or the pigness of the pig, the horseness of the horse, or what have you, the treeness of the tree. Like, if you understand what these things have to offer, then you can perform however it is you're supposed to be towards this particular discrete being. You can do that in the best way possible because you understand what it does. And instead of oppressing it, you can actually help it, which I think is a very sort of quote unquote permaculture idea, is this concept of working with nature rather than against it. And that is something that is very much a part of the Islamic tradition for those who have a proper understanding of it. And again, we've seen how a proper understanding of the tradition is able to produce something that is quite remarkable. And again, the really great historical example is again, what was seen in Moor Spain or Muslim Spain. There's a wonderful book that's referred to in the G.T. Wrench text. And it's also a book that was referred to in the Rodale Book of Composting, which that's the first place that I had seen reference made to it. And it's called Kitab al-Filaha. And it was written by a Muslim scholar named Ibn al-Awam. And it's basically a book detailing all of the methods, or many of the methods, that were used to create the things that were found in Al-Andalus, which again is one of the names that's ascribed to Muslim Spain. And, you know, many writers many historians have referred to what was seen there as being, again, quite remarkable. And I think really what fueled the creation of that particular system were the ethical sensibilities that are found within the Islamic tradition. And this is something that actually was referred to by G.T. Wrench in his text, because right after he talked about what was found in Muslim Spain, he basically provides an abridged version of the biography of the Prophet Muhammad. Because what he ascribed to, again, the creation of that system, he said what really underpins the creation of the system is a particular ethical sensibility that helped to form it.
Within the Christian tradition, you might say that the ethics are things like the Golden Rule. Is there anything explicit like that in Islam?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think with regard to the Golden Rule, there sort of is a version of the Golden Rule that could probably be taken as sort of a general overview of what directs the conduct of the Muslim, of the adherent to Islam. And it's actually very similar to the Golden Rule that's found within Christianity, or quoted within the Christian tradition. This idea that you should treat others in the manner that you want to be treated. But what's interesting about the version in the Islamic tradition is that there's actually a sort of a conditional statement that is tacked along to that idea. And what it says is that none of you can be said to be a true believer. None of you truly believes in God. Your claim to believe in God cannot be said to be true unless you wish for others what you wish for yourself. So it's not simply a matter of wishing for others what you wish for yourself. The idea is that your claim to belief is not valid unless you conduct yourself in a manner that prefers others over yourself. So that's certainly something that is an idea that's found within the tradition. But there's also very explicit reference made to this idea of stewardship repeatedly, over and over again in the Quran. There are lots and lots of references made to nature, also to farming. There's actually a really great book that was put together by a professor at Cornell University called Farming by the Book. And I can't remember the name of the professor at the moment, but the title of the book is called Farming by the Book. And what he's done is he's taken out all of the references from the Torah, the Bible, and the Quran, all the references that are made to farming, and placed them into one text. And so, you know, we see a lot of references made in the source material within these traditions, in particular within Islam. But there's also a couple of really great references that come directly from Hadith tradition. And there's a term in Arabic, it's called Ihya al-Mawat, or the revival of dead lands, or Tahsin al-Ard, or the enrichment of land. It's an idea that there is a reward to be gained from those that take up this activity of reviving dead land. And actually, I'll give you two specific quotes that are attributed to the Prophet Muhammad, who declared that sort of fructifying the earth is a profoundly ethical act. And he said, whoever revives dead land for him or her is reward in it. And whatever any creature seeking food eats of it shall be reckoned as charity for him or charity from him. And then another quote is, there is no Muslim who plants a tree or sows a field and a human bird or animal eats from it, but it shall be reckoned as charity from him. So, you know, it's an activity that provides people with an opportunity to give them sort of a perpetual means to gain the rewards that are seen from offering charity to not only people, but also to animals.
That's just a really powerful statement about ethics and the way that we should act and treat our land and our animals.
That's another powerful idea. Now that I just said that there is a belief that, you know, on the Day of Judgment, everybody and everything has its day before God, right? Everything is given the opportunity to be able to gain recompense from being wronged, you know, during the course of its life. Everything testifies. One of the things that testifies on the Day of Judgment before God against those that have wronged it is the earth. The earth actually testifies. The earth has its day. So that's also sort of a very powerful idea to contemplate, is that even the earth itself is given its day to receive its just due for any wrongs that were done against it. So this idea that the earth is your mother, I mean, that's also an idea you'll find within the Islamic tradition. There's also a tradition, a quote from the Prophet Muhammad that says that paradise lies at the foot of your mother. So that's an allusion not only to your literal mother, you know, the one that brought you into the world, but also this idea that, you know, Mother Earth, the thing that sustains you and provides you with the things which allow you to exist. It's also very important that you give the earth its just due, because it deserves it. It demands it.
Just for me, as just a lay person, it's a very powerful idea that the earth would have a place in this reckoning at the end, that as we, I don't know within the Islamic tradition how humanity is judged, but the way that I was raised within a Christian tradition was this idea that we go before God at the end of days, and then essentially we're tallied, and if we sought forgiveness, actually meant our forgiveness, so you couldn't really do a deathbed confession unless you really believed in it. No, I'm going sideways.
I understand where you're going. I think there is, like any spiritual tradition, I think there's a premium that's put on seeking forgiveness. Then I think there's also a premium placed on being sincere. This idea of sincerity, what in Arabic is called ikhlas, or being mukhlis, being sincere. I mean, that's really what your life is all about, is sort of this process of you arriving to a place where you can be very truthful and very sincere in what it is that you do. Hopefully, you know, being sincere in your goodness as opposed to being sincere in your badness, you know, or your evil. But there's an ayah in Quran that basically says there's this idea where, you know, no one is permitted into the paradise, the Jannah, that you aren't granted admission except that you have a sound heart, that you have a clean heart, you have a sound sort of peaceful heart. And your spiritual practice is supposed to be a means by which you arrive at that place where your heart is made sound. Now, the idea that your acts are being tallied, and hopefully at the end of your life, when you look at sort of your good acts in relation to your bad acts, that the good is going to outweigh the bad in the balance. Ultimately, the thing that you have to rely upon is the mercy of God. And that is really at the core of what we believe, is that nothing supersedes the mercy of God. Even there's what's called a hadith qudsi, which is a sort of a tradition it's a collection of quotes that are attributed to God that were said by the Prophet Muhammad. And one of the things that the Prophet quotes God in saying is that he has made incumbent upon himself that his mercy outweigh his wrath. So that ultimately the overriding quality you find in everything is mercy. And even at the end of, as you said, the end of days, even in the afterlife, that it's the mercy of God that ultimately is what we rely upon. There's a tradition that's told about a man who is said to stand before God on the Day of Judgment. And he's a very righteous man, sort of did everything that one is expected to do or one would ideally do in being a righteous person. You know, he did all of his prayers and he fasted and he gave charity and he made Hajj and he did all of these things. And so it came to a point where God asked the man, do you want to be permitted access to paradise or admitted to paradise by your acts or by my mercy? So he's given the choice. And so the man, thinking that, well, I've done everything that I was expected to do, you know, and I feel as though, you know, I've done enough to be admitted on the basis of my acts. So he told God, I want to be admitted by my acts. And upon his saying that, God opened the door to Jahannam, to the fire, to the hell. And at that moment, the man realized his error, that your acts are not greater than the mercy of God. But what your acts, the acts that you perform, your religious acts, are really, they're a testament of gratitude. They're an act of gratitude for being given the gift of faith. And that in performing those acts, they are sort of a proof of your claim to believing. That if you believe in these things, in this set of particular items that are supposed to account for a person's faith, that there are certain acts that serve as a testament to the claim of belief. But ultimately, what you benefit from are not necessarily the acts in and of themselves. Ultimately, the thing that you have to rely upon at the end of the day is the mercy of God. Your acts are not greater than the mercy of God, is ultimately what that means.
So then within that, because one of the attributes of God is mercy, that regardless of your life on earth, you could still be granted admittance to the afterlife because of God's mercy?
Well, it's funny. There's a tradition that says that a person could live their entire life as a person of the fire, that someone could live their entire life as a person of the fire and come within a handspan of death and become a person of paradise, and vice versa, that a person could spend their entire life living as a person of paradise and come within a handspan of their death and then become a person of the fire, that no one knows the end of anyone else's affair, right? So no one has any right to judge anyone else because you don't know, you have no idea as to what the end of a person's life may be. So to presume that you can judge someone simply based upon sort of outward appearances, you don't have the ability or the authority to make that determination because you don't know the entire course of that person's life. So it's not guaranteed. Like, it's not guaranteed for anybody. But what you can ensure for yourself is at least you're sincere in your effort, in your struggling to be better than you are. Like that each day is hope, you're hopefully making some improvement in the person that you were. You're somehow a little bit better than you were. You know, it's like the difference between an endurance race and a sprint, and that you try to sort of strategically move through, you know, the course of your life in a manner that you're allowed to maintain a pace which will allow you to steadily keep getting better in any number of ways. And often, you know, what you'll find is that many times the most remarkable people, the best people, the folks who have sort of the best state are the ones that you would least suspect. They're not the people you would necessarily think would be in the best of states. So outward appearances can be very misleading, you know. So sort of having the humility to assume the best of people, you know, this idea of giving people the benefit of the doubt, this idea of giving people excuses. There is this concept of excusing people, you know, to grant your brother 70 excuses. That even when you see somebody do something that's wrong, that you sort of give them the benefit of the doubt. Well, maybe this person is doing such and such. Or maybe this person is doing that because of so-and-so. You don't assume the worst. You assume the best. That idea is something that is very much a part of the tradition. In Arabic, it's called husn adhan, having a good opinion. You know, that's a really foundational concept within the Islamic tradition.
So there's this idea of not judging, which within the Christian tradition, as I understand it, there's that idea of, you know, judge not lest you be judged.
Exactly.
Let he who is without sin cast the first stone.
Exactly. You know, there's a very similar concept. You aren't in a position to judge, because if we were to expose everybody, every person could look at themselves and they could say, you know, think about what it is that they do sort of in their more weak moments. And if they're very honest and say, you know what, I would be embarrassed if other people knew that about me, right? If they were able to see these aspects of me. And you would like to think that people would extend the courtesy of not exposing your faults or overlooking your faults. And that in and of itself is a type of mercy. You know, forgiveness or forgiving people is something that's also very, we were talking about this earlier, that forgiveness is a hugely important concept as well. It's actually one of the attributes of God, al-Ghafur or al-Ghafar, the forgiver or the forgiving. Forgiveness is very much something that could be, that would be associated with mercy or compassion, is being able to give people the benefit of the doubt in that, you know, maybe this person has a weakness that prevents them from being able to overcome this flaw that they have to deal with that, you know, at the moment. They don't have the wherewithal to prevent themselves from doing a particular thing. So you sort of have enough sympathy or regard for a person and allowing them the opportunity to be able to handle this thing without being exposed to people or without making them feel worse than they may already feel for having that flaw. That's very much, again, it's something you'll find within the tradition.
You were talking about that personal struggle, that is part of your work of faith because of God's mercy.
Grace, you can also use that as well.
And that struggle, or even though you may have failings and those moments of weakness, as long as you're working towards that, if you will, good end, for lack of better words in my own thoughts right now, that is the struggle of faith.
I feel like I know where you're going. There is this idea or this understanding that sort of this realm, that the world that we live in is, it's not the realm of repose. You know, this isn't the place that you sort of come to chill. This is sort of the crucible. This is the forge. This is the means by which you become a more sort of rarefied being. Like, you have certain challenges, you have certain struggles, you have things about yourself, or you have things about the world that you have to overcome. And it's by means of that struggle that you become better. I often like to use metallurgy. If you look at the way gold is purified, you have to change the state of gold. You have to go from its solid state, you have to expose it to heat so it becomes liquefied, and the dross comes to the top, and you're able to take the dross off of the top of the gold, and then eventually you can take the gold away from the heat and you have a more pure sample. But in order for the sample to be purified, you had to hold it to heat. You had to actually force it to change state. The same thing can be said for, even more so, the making of blades or a sword. You can take a sort of an ingot of steel, you put it in a forge, you make it change state to the point that it becomes no longer magnetic. And then you take it out as it's, you know, it's glowing red, and then you hammer it. You know, you're forging this steel, you're hammering it, and then you quench it, and then you put it back in the forge and you heat it back up. And then you put it back on the, you know, the anvil and or the air hammer, and you again, bang it out some more. That process is what actually makes the metal better than it was. You actually change the grain structure, the grain size of the steel. And eventually, once it's gone through enough of those cycles, what you end up with at the end of the process is very different and is a much higher quality than what you had at the beginning. But in order for it to get to the point where it was made better, you had to put it through all of these different processes where it changed state, and it had to be hammered, and it had to be formed. You know, our lives are the same way, is that so much of our lives is about struggle. and that, you know, all of the people that we look to as examples, all the people we admire, not only within sort of religious tradition, but also just generally, you know, throughout history, they've all been people who've been tested. They've all been people that had a really difficult time in their lives. And it was by virtue of those challenges that they were made better. They were tests. They had to go to places within themselves that otherwise they wouldn't have to look. We apply that to the Islamic tradition. I mean, that's certainly the story of the Prophet Muhammad, is that, you know, for 23 years during the time that the revelation that Islam was being revealed and all of the events that are associated with it, it was a time of immense struggle. The funny thing is that the people that he was struggling against were people that knew him. They were family, people from his tribe. There were people that knew that he was an honorable man, that were very familiar with his lineage, that knew his character. And in spite of that, because what he was proposing to the people he was coming into contact with, the power brokers of the time, if you will, what he was proposing was so radical, if you will, for a risk using that word radical, was so different than what they were used to, that in spite of knowing this person to be an honorable man, they couldn't sort of countenance what it was he was proposing in terms of his advocating for the poor, his advocating for women, this very sort of egalitarian ethic that he was putting forward. He, you know, explicitly talked about there not being any differentiation in the intrinsic value of an Arab and a non-Arab, or between a black person and a white person, that the value and the importance of treating women well and granting them their rights. I think a lot of people don't realize that a lot of what was in the way of rights that had been granted to women within the tradition of Islam far preceded what had occurred in Europe by centuries. Unfortunately, I think a lot of what's within the tradition has been supplanted by certain cultural understandings that come from sort of pre-Islamic times. When you go to different regions or different peoples, different areas of the world, and they sort of have infused the tradition with these understandings that actually go very much against what is actually found within the tradition if you actually look at a lot of the source material and a lot of the historical references that are made. These are things that I think are very much related to this idea of struggle, is that you often you go against the grain of sort of the zeitgeist of the time, is that you're going to meet a lot of resistance, but it's pretty consistent with the people and the personalities that had made an attempt to do something significant, you know, in any and every historical era. You know, you kind of find yourself in good company if you're willing to take up the challenge.
One of the questions then that I have is, in our conversation setting up this formal portion of the interview, you talked about that the Satan figure is a tempter, or someone who like provides you with the suggestion for something, but then you get to choose whether or not you follow that. Do I have that?
In a way, yeah. I mean, basically, this whole concept of free will, you know, you have the ability to choose whether or not you want to do something. It doesn't mean that even in being able to choose, it doesn't mean you'll necessarily accomplish it. You know, whether or not the thing that you choose will be facilitated is that's another matter. But you do have the ability to choose, which is very different to, say, what we believe is the reality of the angels. For example, we believe that angels are just, they are made to sort of carry out orders, if you will. So they can't disobey. Within the sort of the Islamic cosmology, you know, that's the space that they sort of occupy, is that they have a particular MO. And like everything in existence has a particular MO. Animals have a particular MO, and they're sort of acting out or performing the job that their form and their function calls for. The human being has sort of this ability to be able to make the choice as to whether or not they're going to do something. And then there's a particular set of kind of consequences or whatever that comes from that, making that choice. Now, the figure Shaitan, or again in Quran, is also referred to as Iblis, who, funnily enough, that word Iblis in Arabic, it comes from a root word in Arabic, Ablasa, which basically translates into, you know, the one who despair, or to despair. Abulhas is to despair. So Iblis is one who despaired. Despaired of what? Despaired of the mercy of God, which is, you know, I think, within the portions of the Christian tradition is actually sort of an unforgivable sin to limit God's ability to forgive or to show mercy is sort of to despair of that idea or that reality, I should say. That's why suicide, for instance, is such an odious sin, is because it's an act of complete desperation, like total complete despair. And it's something that is sort of the ultimate expression as to the bad opinion that one may have about God. But in talking about what kind of sort of Shaitan represents, is he's sort of this very sort of jealous, very envious figure who envies the favor that God has shown to man by preferring man in spite of what he, as a jinn that was brought into the company of the angels, he sort of preferred this new creation over what he had seen in himself as being superior to this thing that was made from clay, from earth. Iblis is, or Shaitan is made from fire, being that he's from the jinn. So he imagined himself as being superior by virtue of his being made from fire. And then also he was, before the creation or the emergence of the human being, he had been a very sort of dedicated worshiper of God. Actually, it's said about Shaitan is that there isn't a place on earth that Shaitan or Iblis had not put his head to the ground in an act of prayer. So he's prayed every place on earth. But the unfortunate thing is that all of those acts of worship had not softened his heart. It had not made him more of a sort of an obedient follower or a more trusting in the decisions of God. If anything, it made him more suspicious, because in his refusal to follow the order of God and sort of bowing to the human being and bowing to Adam, he challenged the decision that God was making and saying, well, why do you want me to bow down to Adam? Because I'm better than he is. In the narrative, the question is put to Iblis, like, what makes you think you're better than what I've created? He says, well, I'm made from fire and he's made from clay. And so he's making this assessment based on a quality that is not an adequate measure of the relative worth of one in relation to the other. So rather than all of these acts of worship, again, making him more inclined to listen or to trust in the decision of God, it made him suspicious and it made him envious and ultimately an enemy of the human being. And so now everything that Shaitan does is an attempt to undermine the human being, to sort of show God what a mistake he thinks that God made in preferring the human being over him. So that's the whole appeal of sort of the whisperings of the devils, right? The whispering of the devil is to undermine the human being and to cause him to do things that he shouldn't do, because it's an attempt to prove his inferiority. It's an attempt to prove his weakness so that the devil can say, I was right in doing what I did. And essentially, God was wrong for making the decision that he made. So it's sort of the ultimate act of suspicion of the wisdom of God. And in many ways, this is sort of like the underpinning of, I think, of a lot of arguments for people who are not necessarily agnostic, but definitely for people who are atheists. And, you know, and of course, people are entitled to believe what they believe. But I think the problem with sort of the thinking and sort of the disbelief of there even being a possibility of there being a God is that basically God doesn't do the things that I expect God to do, or things don't occur in the manner that I believe they should. So on the basis of you having a particular preference for how events should unfold, because it doesn't happen in the way that you think it should, or your reason tells you it should, then that's the proof of there not being a God, because it doesn't make sense to you. And so essentially that's sort of the same reasoning that this figure Iblis, right, the devil or Shaitan or Satan, that's the same reasoning he uses, that this isn't happening in the way that I think it should. So I'm not going to listen to you anymore.
But this goes back to two pieces of this conversation. One that you touched on in the first piece that we recorded was about how God is unknowable to us that we can't know God directly, but we can know his attributes.
Right.
So that with Satan, it's a matter that Satan was given form and purpose by God, and in the end rejected that. Also because he felt that within the order and the hierarchy, because he was made of fire, that made him better than man, but God gave everything a form and a place and a purpose.
Right. And then ultimately what Satan was doing, what Shaitan was doing, was questioning the wisdom of God, questioning the order that was put into place by God, because if God didn't do what he felt as though he should be doing, what Shaitan felt as though he should be doing. So because he didn't get his way, he took that as a reason to disobey or to not follow the order, is because it was no longer according to what he preferred. So now belief, right? His belief is no longer based upon sort of the reality of reality. It's entirely predicated on whether or not he likes what's happening or whether or not he prefers what's happening. And the moment things don't happen in the way that he prefers, he's like, the deal's done. I'm not down with this. It's a very interesting way to, I mean, just sort of examine the thinking, is that if it's sort of like, if I can use a sports analogy, like you're a fan of the team as long as the team wins, right? And in the moment the team loses, you're not a fan anymore. It's the fair weather fan phenomenon, right? What kind of fan is that? What kind of belief is one that's predicated on everything happening in the manner that you think it should or you want it to? There's a beautiful ayah in the Quran, and it comes in the form of a question, and it sort of speaks to this idea, is that, you know, did you think that you could simply say that you believe and that you wouldn't be tested, right? It's a powerful idea that, you know, you can say that, oh, yeah, I'm down with this. Okay, we're going to find out just how much you're down with it, because the test of your testament or your claim to belief comes when things happen that you don't want or that you don't like or that you don't prefer. So what happens when times get tough? What happens when it starts to get a little rocky? Do you pull out? You know, is it a done deal? Like, I'm not on this ride anymore. I don't like it. So what kind of belief is that? That idea, I mean, is very much recognized, or it's already sort of been identified within sort of the realm of possibilities within the tradition itself. It's sort of what you'll find when you read the Quran is it talks about archetypes, like they're patterns of behavior. So just like in permaculture, we talk about, you know, patterns that exist within natural phenomena. Well, you see the same thing, the same idea that's talked about, you know, within the Quran itself, is that there's sort of these patterns of certain sort of psychological or spiritual profiles. There isn't one that isn't already identified within the book. So there's nothing new under the sun. There's nothing anybody could like kind of bring forward and say, oh, this is a new thing. No, it's like it's the same archetype. And you just happen to fall within it, you know, so it's just a matter of identifying, you know, well, what archetype do you fit?
Did you say that it was an ayah?
Yeah, like a verse. Ayah actually means a sign. So each verse of the Quran is called like a sign of God, or a sign of the of sort of the existence or sort of the being of God.
I find that question answers, in many ways, a lot of the questions that I've had about faith over the years, because it's that idea. Well, how can a merciful God allow these horrible things to happen?
And that was Ramis Kent. As you heard there at the end, his description of temptation and belief and faith kind of answered some questions for me that I had always had that were not answered in previous conversations with people who were more knowledgeable about faith practices and spiritual traditions than I was. And I'm thankful to be given a glimpse into that through this conversation with Ramis. His comments about being tested and the way that that allows us to be forged by our struggles bears a certain weight on me at the moment in the place that I find myself, but also in that need to be honest and open. And that within the story and context of the culture that I find myself in the United States, it's easy sometimes to prescribe myself to a particular view of how I should be and how my interaction with that world should be. I remember when I started a job in business that, you know, you separate your personal life from your private life. But how are those two lives really different? Because I am the person in the workplace that I am when I am outside of it. Why can't those be a holistic whole? And much of the feedback that I've received over the last several weeks has been about how refreshing it is to hear open and honest vulnerability. And I wonder how approaching what we do in this work of building a better world could be changed and made better if we could all find ourselves in a place to be like that, to be ourselves without fear of judgment, accepting of ourselves, providing forgiveness for others, and truly live as an example of the world that we want to see. I know I'm going to be turning that one over for a while yet. So while I do that, if you'd like to share your thoughts with me, please do. I'd love to hear from you. show@thepermaculturepodcast.com is the email address to do so, or you can give me a call, 717-827-6266. Connect via Facebook, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast, or on Twitter, where I am @permaculturecst. And as I say, this is a listener-supported show, so if you could make a small recurring monthly donation, it would really help and allow me to do more of this work. Go to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. You'll see a couple of drop-down boxes, the first one of which is for the monthly contributions, and they start at $5 and go on up from there. Below that is a one-time contribution starting at 10. But thank you for taking this time to join me and listen to another piece on faith and earth care. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.